We open the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Today's Thursday, March 23rd. Sorry for getting started a little bit late here. Let me open the public hearing that we carried over from Tuesday on House Bill 3016 and ask Representative Evans to join us and tell us about he and I's bill, if I remember right. I co-sponsored this. I'm not going to come sit with you, but I'm with you in spirit.
Thank you, Chair Clem. And thank you, Chair Clem. Members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Evans. I represent House District 20, Monmouth Independence, West Salem, parts of South Salem, one of the prettiest districts in the state. The bill before you is very simple, and as I've been trying to figure out how to explain the journey on this one, it's very simple. I don't know how many of you have ever read the book Animal Farm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But in this particular case, this bill is trying to find a way to make sure that all animals are equal. If you remember the story from the book, all animals were equal after the revolution, and then some animals became more equal than other animals. I use that because in this particular situation, what's happening is that at least in one county, and I understand perhaps others, but at least one, in the area outside a city, but inside the urban growth boundary, but in an area of the urban growth boundary that will never be developed because of the way they developed it, meaning that it would be just too costly for the city ever to actually put in sewer lines, roads, et cetera, to make that work, it is de facto long-term county activities. And many of the folks that live in this area do all types of farming activities. One such person wanted to raise hogs in addition to raising other four-legged animals that I can't remember and is not really relevant. But ironically, in this particular county, you can't raise hogs in that particular area. So I asked myself, what do hogs do? The answer is, people evidently at some point decided they wanted to have a policy to make sure that hogs couldn't be there. Now here's the conundrum. If you want to live in a city, you accept living in the city. In fact, many cities have some type of annexation vote process, some more engaged than others. In the county, especially in this particular county, it has a right to farm rule that is withheld, understood, accepted, long-term practice. It's in this little shadow area that is technically in the urban growth boundary, but has a number of single occupancy dwellings and small, I don't know what the right term is anymore, hobby farms, et cetera. And in this particular case, kids and grandkids want to raise pigs. I didn't think this would be that difficult. And then this building is full, of course, of ideas that didn't think that would be difficult. The situation is this. It seems to me that if you're outside the city and that you are allowing farm activities, it is weird to exclude a particular species of animals. So I go back to the beginning. I'm old-fashioned. I think that if you're outside the city, you should be able to have farm activities, again, if you're outside the city. And I don't understand the fairness or the long-term strategies involved in excluding one particular species of traditional livestock animal, like pigs, over sheep, over goats, over cows. I don't understand that. And that's what the bill is seeking to rectify. The bill is very simple. It says, look, if you're going to say no farm animals, fine. But if you're going to say some farm animals, you got to say all farm animals. That's it. Wish I had something like more.
Any questions for Representative Evans? Okay, Rep. Barreto.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. So wouldn't this come under a county ordinance? I mean, if the city's within the county, rather than at a state level, we're coming down and deciding what they should do between a city and a county.
Chair Clem, Representative Brito, yes and no. I mean, to me, it falls under the whole right to farm philosophy, that's being abridged, which is a statewide approach. But right now, it is certainly the county's responsibilities to be able to set those limits. So technically, if the bill never moves, it is exactly what you say. The counties can decide and pick and choose winners and losers.
So that's a good point. I think we may actually even have to get some legal counsel at some point, because the issue is right to farm exists in the state. Right to farm already protects all of this. The right to farm apparently must be able to be terminated within city limits or by... It can't usually be terminated by just a county anywhere, but we may have to dig into why it is that a county could even do this, and maybe our next speaker from AOC can talk to that, because if right to farm exists, for example, except in cities, well, this should already be protected under current law because it's not in a city.
Right.
If right to farm exists only within urban growth boundaries, then yes, that's the question is, are we drawing the right place for right to farm to end, which would be urban growth boundary rather than city limits? And that's what we've got to probably think about. But hopefully someone else knows some of the answers on actually how where right to farm
ends.
Who can terminate right to farm and at what jurisdiction, at what level?
You've got a question over there.
Rep Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things. One is that I believe that in at least my community, that you can be in the urban growth boundary, you can have animals, but once you get into the city, you're grandfathered in until such time that animal is removed, and then it's a different game. So, and I think that's very fair. The other thing is, if this particular area was used as an urban growth boundary that will never be developed, is there any latitude for the city to go back to DLCDC and change their urban growth boundary? Because if this is never going to be developed, there's no sense in even having it in the urban growth boundary.
And that was sort of the point of the bill that came the other day from Central Oregon. It was about areas that just by purpose and pattern are never likely because they're giant lots and all the owners like it that way and they're never going to sell. So how do cities calculate that? Do they count it against their 20-year build-out supply or do they not count it? And I don't know that we got a full answer on that, but several cities at least have told me privately in my office, we already discount that land. We already don't count it, even though it's in the UGB, we don't count it as buildable. So therefore, the UGB would push that. Yeah, but that was a few offhand. I didn't solemnize them or anything.
I think that we got another part of the answer, which was it's part of the new express process, so they have an opportunity to do that, to discount it in that process.
That's right. Yeah, so we have this House Bill 2254 from a few sessions ago. It's called the Fast Track. I think it's only for small cities, though, not for
cities.
Yeah, and in that one, they definitely had a procedure for discounting unlikely to develop land, but I don't know in the normal UGB or in metros. Okay. No, any further questions for Rep. Evans? All right, let's see what AOC can tell us. They've craftily not listed whether they're for, against, or neutral on the bill, so we'll find out.
They're not for.
Not so into it? Well, now that you're here to oppose my bill, why don't you tell us how it's going? No, just kidding. Just kidding.
For the record, Mark Nystrom with the Association of Oregon Counties. Chair Clem, members of the committee, I just found out about this bill earlier this week, so I started doing a little bit of research. The area in question is zoned in what's called suburban residential zone, which is a special land use code that would be an area that is going to transition between urban and rural, and within the next 10 years be incorporated into the community. So I called the land use planner there in Polk County, and this applies to other counties. This is just a illustrative example. But he said, actually, this is he can't talk about it because it's actually going through a quasi-judicial review, and it's going to get changed zoning. So hopefully the person in question can actually raise the swine that they want to raise. And it is, in fact, swine that are called out as the one animal you can't raise.
They say why? Just doesn't
like
them?
Well, if you guys, to carry on the animal farm reference, they're the ones who end up taking over the farm and get the attack dogs.
Oh,
and
my God.
So,
yeah, but
that's
true. Smart ones.
So we're worried about, it's not.
Senator, this is what we do in this committee. This is kind of what we do the whole day.
Just have fun.
Quick, though. I asked Marianne if she could come in so that we could talk about the right to farm stuff. But it's one sentence. Raising livestock is permitted within a minimum of 1 acre for the first animal unit. And or a fraction thereof, and 1/2 acre for each animal unit thereafter. So this is how they define it. Cattle, horses, burros, donkeys, and other animals of comparable size constitute one animal unit. 5 animals the size of sheep or goat are constitute one animal unit. All animals and fowls should not be allowed to run off the property, and swine are not allowed on tracts less than 10 acres. So
that's in right to farm. Or that's in the Polk County ordinance.
This is a Polk County ordinance.
Okay.
And the other, I talked to the land use planner, and he said that other counties have similar, if not exact.
So they're allowed, but only on 10 acres or more.
In this particular zone.
In Polk
right
County,
now, what they're changing that area, from what I understand, and he couldn't talk too much about it, they're changing it from that suburban residential to another sort of rural residential zoning.
That so might not carry that
right.
restriction.
Right. So this is this zoning is specifically for areas that are going to eventually move into the city. As Rep. Evans pointed out, this area is probably not going to move into the city. So the people who are interested in this have gone through are in the middle of the process of requesting a zone change.
Okay.
So in our argument, we would say that the process works. It might be a little slower, but we're moving forward.
So, Marianne, what we were talking about before you got summoned was the question of where does right to farm stop? At what boundary, or who can terminate right to farm? A city, a county? Is it the UGB? How does it work?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Marianne Nash with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I was actually just refreshing myself before I came in, so there's a bit of a delay in me coming on Right to Farm. And the way Right to Farm has, is, as I think most of the committees are aware, two components, one being a bar to private actions for nuisance or trespass from a farming or forest practice, and the second being a prohibition on local government regulation of farming and forest practices. And my understanding of both of those is they apply to land zoned for farm or forest use. And the way the statute's structured, if you look at the local government statute, it talks about a prohibition on local regulation where a claim doesn't exist under the private immunity right to farm and forest. And then that portion says no farm or forest practice on land zoned for farm or forest use shall give rise to any private right of action or claim for relief based on nuisance or trespass. So I believe it's where the EFU zoning or the farm or forest zoning starts, and it could be mixed farm forest or forest. So.
So if it's in a UGB, but it's still not, the zone hasn't been changed, then those people are protected. But if it's been changed, or even if it's outside a UGB and it's rural residential 5, right to farm doesn't exist on that.
That would be my understanding, yes.
Okay. So the question in front of us is that the right way to do it? Is it by zone type, or is it by something else, or let counties figure it out?
If I may, Representative Clem, the concern we have is that because it's an all-or-nothing kind of thing, mm-hmm. we're worried that some of the counties will go to the nothing just to avoid conflict with the neighbors.
Yeah. Rep. Power.
Actually, that was going to be my question when I was going to ask a question. In areas that are more urban county areas and incorporated areas, it seems to me if this were to go through, the cleanest thing for them to do would be to then prohibit chickens, ducks, and others that are sort of manageable in more urban spaces. And I don't know if Polk or other counties were struggling with that in some other urban areas, to the best of your knowledge.
Chair Clem, Representative Power, I'm not aware of a struggle with that, but I would guess that in some of those cases, in some of those zones, because we're talking like West Salem here, mm-hmm. and if you go over to the east side of in Marion County and East Salem, mm-hmm. Those are pretty dense residential areas. And so I would guess that if given the choice of having to allow all animals, they might swing in that other direction. Again, I'm speculating, so I can't say.
But that's sort of the point of the local control, as you let each one figure that out.
Yeah.
Rep. Evans.
Chair Clement, again, to this issue, the reason I thought it was time to have a conversation about it, because I've been knowing of not the one case going on, but several over the years, is that as our society is starting to look at growing food more locally and more community-based co-ops, et cetera, if we're going to have farms closer to urban areas but still not in the city, it was just curious to me that swine were called out.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, actually. I can recall properties brought into Salem by Salem from the area in East Salem that somebody referenced, and me getting calls from somebody really mad that their daughter's 4-H pig was going to have to be either donated or slaughtered. And I think there was like a llama maybe on there too that was going to have to be sold and got rid of because the city said, hey, you're now in the city. And I didn't know what to do about it at the time. I don't even think I was in office yet, but I was running for office. Okay. Well, I think we understand the problem here. Does anybody know what a P-S-I-T-T-A-C-I-N-E-S is? How do you even pronounce that?
I don't know how to pronounce it, but I do know it's a parrot because I had to look it up recently.
Citizen.
A parrot?
Parrot.
Citizen.
You can't have a parrot, or you can have a parrot.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, there is another bill this session that's proposing to remove, however you pronounce them, parrots from the definition of livestock. So it's another bill coming up this
parrot
session that we're
tracking. Controversial.
Which is how I came to look it up.
Okay. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Stew on this one for a little while. And let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3016. The Metro one. Committee members, the other day we carried over the Metro work session. This is the sort of kumbaya bill that allows the Metro to do up to 1,000 acres in an intermittent period. Is everybody kind of ready to go here?
Talking about 2095?
2095, yes.
We're good with that.
Okay. Let me open the work session on House Bill 2095. And
do we have
Amendments? Well, I can just do it without a script, but are there amendments or anything?
Let me just get Misty prepared because I'm surprising her out of the blue.
Agriculture.
There are, and I can tell you.
Okay, tell us about these dash ones.
I'm guessing it's
there are.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the dash one amendments make sure that the Metropolitan Service District may not revise the determination, so we're looking at that mid-cycle review, until the district has entered in, until Metro has entered into an intergovernmental agreement and designated rural and urban reserves. It also requires that Metro adopt the urban growth boundary expansion within 4 years of completing their most recent demonstration of sufficient buildable lands, and it exempts them from boundary location requirements in statewide land use planning goals.
Okay, so dash ones.
So, Chair Clem, I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated 2/21/17.
Vice Chair Springer moves to adopt the dash one amendments dated 2/21/17. Any discussion? Any objection? And so adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2095 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Springer moves House Bill 2095 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Vice Chair Springer.
So just a couple points of clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That this is a bill that is really solely about the metro area. And I can't pass up this opportunity to get a little plug in here. This is one of these bills I love to support because I get to support areas of the state that do business and live life totally different from the way we do in our district. Mm-hmm. And when I do this, I always remind myself that I want that same kind of consideration in my district when we do things the way we do them, maybe a little differently. This gives me an opportunity to pay that forward for down the road when maybe I have a bill, some of our rural areas have a bill that's kind of different.
One thing I would like to say here, and we'll say it again on the floor, the legislative intent for at least me in voting for this is that the tool, and this is specific to these dash one amendments that we just adopted, the tool can still be used, let me say this right, even if the urban and rural reserves that the dash ones just said need to be acknowledged before this tool can be used, if they're acknowledged, but some neighbor sues and they're in litigation for the next 5 years, this tool can still be used during that lawsuit time. The acknowledgement is the trigger for when the tool to expand the UGB can be used, not the ultimate final completion of any court challenges, but just the acknowledgement by Metro and the county and LCDC. Okay, and we'll say that again on the floor. Okay, any further discussion? Any objection? Okay, so adopted. Vice Chair McLean, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
Great. Okay, and I've got does Senator Johnson have enough time? She was here first.
Yeah.
Okay. Rep. McLean, can you come up? We are not intentionally sliding the senator, but she's got slightly more time, it appears, luckily. Thank you. All right, so let me open the public hearing on House Bill 3158. Can you tell us about this one?
Thank you, Claire Chim.
Exactly. Thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is Mike McLean. I am a state representative for District 55, a very large rural district with lots and lots of hunting grounds and enthusiastic people who enjoy hunting. House Bill 3158 is co-chief sponsored by the head of our Sportsman Caucus, Representatives Witt and Esquivel, and then also co-sponsored by the vice chair of your committee, Representative Springer. We think to bring assistance to the ODFW and our state patrols on poaching is needed. And an idea was given to me by Sean Jones, an outfitter and guide for many years. He's prepared to testify by phone. And it's based upon a Utah House Bill 3158 based upon a Utah reward program that has been successful. Bottom line is we have evidence and that the poaching is increasing and that the current system may need some assistance to bring that down. Poaching is unethical. It's illegal. It's wrong. Those of us who hunt regularly and are enthusiastic supporters of sportsmen all across Oregon want to decrease poaching, and this is an additional way. Just to quote Michelle Dennehy, a Fish and Wildlife spokesman, quote, if we look at the illegal take, it's basically equal to the legal take. It's bad. Poaching is not ethical. It's not hunting. And they specifically, an article about some areas where the mule deer population in Oregon have endured poaching at such high numbers, it equaled the legal take. So one way to do it and not cost money is to offer up a program which incents hunters, and if incents any Oregonian, whether they're hunting or not. But if you turn in a poacher, and the poacher's convicted, you would there'd be a program which would make available to you a tag in that unit, and preferably even for that species. One idea also could be that you could get preference points. Currently, the TIP program rewards for money. We're realizing that the financial incentive of turning in poachers is not as pervasive as we had hoped in this state. So one way to compensate people who turn in poachers is to pay them not in money, but in tags. Or preference points, which could be used for any tags. So those are the types of programs that other states have used. Oregon, this bill would have the Department of Fish and Wildlife come up with a way to incent them with that. I'd be happy to turn it over to and have us call Sean Jones, and who is a professional outfitter and guide and can talk based upon his personal experience and also what he has heard in the industry. So if you're ready, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Okay, 9-1-5-4-1.
With that, I hear no dial tone.
419-1027. On Rick.
I feel like I should hear a dial tone.
How are we doing this morning?
Good. Oh, you just hung up.
Oh, rats. Sorry about that.
I feel like we should hear a dial tone. Dial tone? No? What was it again? Technical issues, sorry.
Don't do that. You can do that. You can be on the other side.
I feel like there should be a dial tone.
I could do the...
Yeah, could, yeah we could...
Is there no dial tone?
We're going to check our line and do this all on the record because that's how we
I believe Sean is watching online and...
Tapping.
Maybe sorry, aware. Sean. We're trying. We may use our cell phones here in a second. This is horrible. Thank you.
Mr. Chan, hi.
Yeah. Chair Springer. Yeah, while you're here. Yeah.
Or something here.
Yeah.
So we had a conversation about this bill in our house just a couple of days ago. And I'm hoping somebody today will answer this question. I am under the impression that if somebody turns in a poacher and it leads to a conviction, there's a $500 reward, if you will. I'd like that confirmed or denied. That comes on information from our almost 20-year-old son that lives in Eastern Oregon and hates poaching and is a poor college student and looking for money anywhere he can get it. That said, when I mentioned this bill to him, and he said, you know, the $500 is, that's a nice chunk. And I said, this would possibly mean an additional, and correct me if I'm wrong, an additional tag for a bighorn sheep, which we know is a once-in-a-lifetime tag, based on the draw, or an additional antelope tag, which is once in 5 years. So are those true statements? Because I got to tell you, he got quite excited about the opportunity of some really cool tags, more than the $500 for tuition.
Well, thank you, Chair Clem and Vice Chair Springer. I certainly am loath to not tell something a voter wants to hear. However,
I am correcting his thought because he thinks he gets $500 if he turns someone in.
Yes. But I'd say this. I don't think the once-in-a-lifetime tags are on the table. The idea being is that...
That's bad news.
It would. The Utah program, which is their rule 657-5-22, and what they did and found success is that you get either the preference points towards the tag of your choice or towards like an elk hunt or something that's a little bit harder to get. Or you get if you catch someone hunting a bighorn sheep, poaching. If you get someone poaching, then they're successfully convicted.
Right.
You would get a tag for a bighorn sheep.
Yeah.
So there would be the potential. Now, obviously, if it it's a way to turn 19-year-old young men, like I have one and you have one, and if they want to, you know, be out there and saying, you know, we think we saw a poacher, and by God, we're going to turn him in, instead of this, like, It certainly erases the hesitation, and that's what we want.
Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I'm just sorry. I'm doing something over here, too. Please, keep talking.
But I do think we all want to be careful that we do not want to encourage our 19-year-olds to go play Game Cop out there so they can get extra tax.
Yes.
Okay, one moment,
good
please.
Point. Fair
just
point.
One moment.
We,
like the preference.
We, Representative Springer, that's a fair point. I suppose there could be a day where if this program was so successful that we have, you know, posses of 19-year-old young men flooding the hills to, you know, to try to catch poachers, that would be an unwanted invitation into law enforcement. But based on the 19-year-olds I know, nobody likes poachers. And but the $500 to turn in a poacher is not cutting it. So this is a no-cost way to the state, in essence, to incentivize hunters and people to turn in poachers because they get something worth more than cash, preference points, or a chance at a hunt that they wouldn't otherwise get. But they have to turn in the poacher, and the poacher has to be convicted.
Right.
So it's not you have to follow through, you have to testify, you have to help with the conviction of the poacher. And realize, and I hope the committee knows, we're seeing an increase in poaching, and it's wrong. And this is a creative and innovative way to assist our law enforcement in cracking down. But I understand, Mr. Chair, you have Sean Jones.
We got him. Okay, Sean, we've got you here live in the Capitol, on the phone. Can you tell us your name for the record and then tell us your thoughts on this bill?
Yes, my name is Sean Jones, and I want to thank Representative Clem and Vice Chair Springer. Over the last 20 years, I've had the opportunity to participate here in Oregon, not only in hunting, but guiding hunters throughout the state, as well as managing ranch lands here in Oregon. Poaching has had a massive impact on wildlife, and those impacts are really not limited just to the animals in the overall population, but really, there's significant monetary losses that happen throughout the counties as a result of these declining populations. In 2010, the ODF&W estimated that we lost over 85,000 mule deer since its original peak population. And since that time, our management objectives are 130,000 animals below what is desired. So significant losses of mule deer and undoubtedly elk at the same time. There was a study in 2005 that was conducted through 2011 that collared and what that revealed was that there were more mule deer illegally taken than were legally taken by both rifle and archery hunters combined. So significant impacts are out there from the poachers. Now, Representative McLean, the TIP program has not necessarily been incentive enough for sportsmen to turn in poachers. I recently spoke to one of the OSP officers here locally who had handled a case out in Jefferson County where a poacher had taken over 100 mule deer illegally. It turned out over 30 of his friends and family knew about the poaching, but soon they saw no reason to turn him in. Now, having been a hunter and a guide here in Oregon, I've been able to hear from guides in Utah how money wasn't the key factor in getting legal hunters to turn in illegal hunters. What's worked there, and what I believe will work here, is giving hunters a greater incentive through rewarding them with either premier tags or large numbers of preference points. If you offer a sportsman $500 for turning in a poacher, it doesn't have nearly the incentive of giving that same hunter 10 preference points for maybe one of his favorite hunting areas or one of Oregon's premier hunts. I think these types of incentives will cost the state almost nothing. It will engage sportsmen in doing a significant amount of work and keeping their ear low to the ground, listening for the stories of who poached what, and then turning them into the OSP. And officially, doing a lot of the work for our game officers who,
there are very few of. Okay. Thanks, Sean. Any questions for Sean? Okay. Thanks for calling in. So what I'm going to do is take a little pause on this bill and get Senator Johnson up here, and then we'll come back to it. Any more questions for Rep. McLean? All right. Thanks for joining us. So let me, for now, close the public hearing on House Bill 3158. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3234 and 2784. Ask Senator Johnson to join us. Rep. McKeown, do you want to stay or go down? Whatever you feel. Sorry for the technical delays and the other delays. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, I'm Betsy Johnson. I represent District 16. I deeply appreciate your attention to urbanized swine. I've spent many a sleepless night worrying about porcine presence in populated areas.
Oh, so my God.
Riveting testimony.
That's why we did it, Senator.
Thank you, sir.
Would you like to begin?
Yes, because I'm going to scoot. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I am here in support of House Bill 2784 and House Bill 3234. These two bills represent an enormous amount of work and effort led very capably by Representative McKeown that took us all up and down the coast, hearing testimony from a variety of experts in various locations about the importance of shellfish propagation, shellfish preservation to economies along the coast. This really is a far-reaching bill in that it attempts to deal with some of the very pernicious problems that are faced by shellfish producers right now. They range from locations of plats to ocean conditions. You will hear shortly from Dr. Umrell and other experts that were with us during this tour, but I'm really here in front of her colleagues and peers in the House to say that Representative McKeown did an excellent job shepherding this group through some very complicated conversations about the importance of shellfish to our coastal economies. And with that, I'm going to leave this in her capable hands, as well as our supporting staff of experts, and commend these two bills for your consideration. They mean a great deal to the coast. They're fully endorsed by the Coastal Caucus. And hopefully, for those of you that are wearing crustacea on your lapels or bivalves on your lapels, this is an opportunity to give a badly needed economic boost to coastal places and to keep Oregon's culinary reputation alive and well globally with the quality of our bounty from the ocean. So with that, I'm going to excuse myself unless there are any questions.
And as Senator Johnson is exiting, for the record, Catty McKeown, House District 9, I'd like to acknowledge that there are two bills here. One is the very, very in-depth policy bill that is the culmination of 32 recommendations that came out of this task force. The second bill, 3234, is the actual money bill. We realize there's a big tag on this. We'd like these to go down to Ways and Means for the capable guidance of Senator Johnson as we go through the Ways and Means process and figure out what is in the realm of possible in funding these initiatives that came out of this endeavor. So thank you, Senator Johnson.
Thank you very much. Thank you, committee.
Chair Clem, would you like me to go ahead and do my brief testimony, or would you like to get back to Representative McLean and finish his first, and then I can kick off to the experts on shellfish?
I think he left, so why don't you go ahead, and then Vice Chair Springer is going to get the experts, and I'm going to go catch Senator Johnson in the hall on a different topic for a second.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Chair Clem. Vice Chairs, members of the committee, once again, for the record, my name is Catty McKeown. I represent House District 9, and I have here before you, as Senator Johnson mentioned, two bills. And I thank you for your time today. In 2015, we worked to create the Oregon Shellfish Initiative in hopes of enhancing and expanding cultivated shellfish production and the restoration of wild shellfish on the Oregon coast. Upon the passage of 2209, the Oregon Shellfish Task Force was created, and I was very pleased to be able to shepherd this through with the capable help of Senator Johnson through a year-long process, as she mentioned, developing a plan that will support and expand this iconic Oregon industry. As I said, the task force's formal recommendations are before you. You will notice that both House Bill 2784 and 3234 have -1 amendments. The original bills were placeholders. The actual content of the bills is in the -1s for each one of those bills. This work is very important to the coast and Oregon's mariculture industry. It's estimated to have an annual direct economic value of $10.6 million, and coming alongside this industry is mutually beneficial, not only for the industry, for the coastal economy, the economy of the state, and again for the iconic brand of Oregon oysters across across the globe. The members of our task force were myself and Senator Johnson. We had the capable participation of Frank Barcellas from the Department of Agriculture. Chief Don Ivey from the Coquel Tribe represented the nine Oregon tribes. Steve Rumrow from ODF&W will be speaking today with Mike Sandin representing ports. Gil Sylvia, the Oregon State University researcher that is the certified smart people were on this task force, I can guarantee you that. Claire Thomas represented the education community. Dick Vandershaft represented the conservation community with the Nature Conservancy. Svein Vies Hansen is here today. We're very lucky to have him off his oyster plat and here to talk to us today representing the industry itself. And we had another commercial grower, Jess Hampel, who represented Oregon oysters. We had seven meetings. The task force developed a very specific set of recommendations that are before you representing we need a state lead agency dealing with this instead of having be spread across agencies. So it brings collaboration of agencies to a sharp point. And the goal is to enhance production, develop best management practices, understand the impacts of ocean conditions, particularly ocean acidification, which you will hear more about in the shellfish, the broodstock issue of how ocean acidification affects how we grow oysters, the socioeconomic costs and benefits. There are land use issues and seeing if there are any other areas where we can increase production. And public education and outreach, particularly for our recreational harvesters, is an important part of this. The assessment of wild shellfish stocks and the restoration of native shellfish, which are Olympia oysters. So the total of 32 recommendations are in front of you. I'm happy to answer questions, colleagues, but what I would like to do is turn this over, Chair Clem, when you think the time is right during this meeting, to let, once again, our certified smart people speak, and they are on your list to speak to who can answer the questions of the specifics of these two bills. So I'm happy to answer questions if you have them on the process, but the guys that know all about this are sitting behind me.
Okay, I think we'll stick with shellfish for the moment, and then we'll go back to the poaching. So let's thank you. Any questions for Rep. McEwen right at the moment? Okay, let's ask Steve Rumrow. Oh boy.
Sven.
After the other bill, I don't want to butcher this. It's not Svein.
Sven.
Wait, what?
Svein.
Svein.
Yep.
Svein, and then is
Vies
it?
Hansen.
Vies Hansen.
Yep.
Svein Vies Hansen.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome. And Chris Langdon. Svein Vies Hansen. So you're Irish. I just get okay. I figured it probably was not. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Good morning, Chairman Clem and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Steve Rumrell. I'm the shellfish program leader for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I served as a member of the Oregon Shellfish Task Force. It was my pleasure to work with Representative McEwen and Senator Johnson and my colleagues on the Shellfish Task Force to bring this issue before you for your consideration today. I'm going to provide a high-level overview of the pathway that we've taken towards an Oregon Shellfish Initiative, and in particular to highlight and describe the recommendations that we put together in the final report. So we can get the technology here. Molluscan shellfish are a particular subgroup of the shellfish that we have here in Oregon. Many of you are wearing the crab on your lapel, and crab are certainly part of Oregon's shellfish, as are the shrimp, sea urchins, gooseneck barnacles. But this shellfish task force limited the scope of our consideration to the Molluscan shellfish. So those include our oysters, bay clams, razor clams, abalone, the Molluscan, the mollusks. As Representative McEwen mentioned and Senator Johnson pointed out, that these shell fisheries in Oregon have great economic value, and they're quite diverse. We have recreational harvest of bay clams and razor clams. Those are harvests of wild stock that occur naturally in our bays and estuaries along our beaches. We also have commercial harvest of those wild stock razor clams and bay clams for bait, for human consumption, And then we also have the commercial mariculture, the commercial farming of our clams and oysters in Oregon as well. And that is another subset of those Alaskan shell fisheries. The estimated economic value of these together, the North Coast crab and clams, for which we have data, now I am lumping those together, is estimated about $38 million a year. Commercial bay clams and razor clam harvest are estimated in that range of $1 to $2 million a year. And the mariculture, commercial mariculture farming of oysters, estimated about $10 million a year. If we subtract out the estimate for recreational crab, I'm just talking about recreational crab, the estimate is about $30 to $35 million a year of economic inputs into our coastal economy. So clearly very valuable to us. Really quickly, what the Development Towards Shellfish Initiative, a state of Oregon Shellfish Initiative, is caught up in the context of some larger initiatives that have taken place in the nation. The National Aquaculture Policy was passed in 2011, followed very quickly within NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, by development of a National Shellfish Initiative in 2011. Very quickly, the state of Washington developed their Washington Shellfish Initiative with tremendous help and assistance from NOAA up in Seattle. And California also developed the Shellfish Initiative in 2013, focusing on some other aspects. Oregon has taken a more slow and deliberate approach. We heeded the good advice from Senator Johnson to not reinvent the wheel, but to adapt that wheel to the context of Oregon, and that's certainly what we've done. So we took steps to move ourselves towards formulating a vision for an Oregon Shellfish Initiative in 2015, 2016, and are now bringing these bills before you. So as Representative McEwen pointed out, House Bill 2209 passed in 2015. With that bill, we established the State of Oregon Shellfish Policy to enhance and expand cultivated shellfish production, also to conserve, protect, and restore wild populations of native shellfish, and also to improve water quality and the health of our aquatic and marine habitats. I won't go into the representatives that served on that committee. One of the critical calls to action that we called for in our final report was to take steps to formalize the Oregon Shellfish Initiative. The Shellfish Task Force was sunsetted at the end of our term, and at this point we have just the recommendations. But we asked in that report to formalize the Shellfish Initiative to give it continued life and to organize that as a multi-year collaborative public-private partnership, a coalition, if you will, to bring together these various interests to advance the goals of the partnership. Also asked to designate representatives and create an oversight committee coordinated jointly by the Oregon Department of Agriculture because of their very important role in management of the cultivated shellfish, and also by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, which has management responsibilities for the wild stock, and commercial and recreational harvest of the wild stock. And then at that time, we also identified a target area of about $3 million. I think we said $2.9 million or so in appropriations to get some of these components started. In particular, the Shellfish Task Force, as Representative McEwen pointed out, offered up 32 detailed recommendations. We also prioritized those by high, moderate, and low in terms of their rank, and assigned a time frame for implementation, immediate, midterm, or long-term. And I'm searching back through, and I think that our definition of immediate was on the time frame of 1 to 2 years, midterm was 2 to 3 years, and longer term was 2 to 5 years. And we also developed up the cost estimates. So those recommendations from the Shellfish Task Force then are now moved over into the two bills that are before you, House Bill 2784, focusing on the complex adjustments to our statutes and rules, coupled with appropriations. There are 17 recommendations in 2784, and also House Bill 3234, focusing primarily on the dollar value appropriations, another 17. 17 and 17 is 34. The Shellfish Task Force developed up 32, so there are two complex recommendations that were in our report that have now been split to address the various aspects of them. So I think we have now 34 recommendations in the two bills. Okay, so I'll just roll through those recommendations really quickly into the under the big umbrella of agency leadership and collaboration at a high priority immediate implementation level. Three recommendations. First, to direct the Department of Agriculture Food Safety Program to serve as the lead agency for coordination of commercial mariculture permitting and management. Also, to ask that agency to hold pre-application conferences among the lease applicants and the resource agencies to help us move more smoothly and effectively through those leasing decisions. And then also to ask them to conduct regular inspections of the shellfish plat lease areas and to enforce compliance with the existing statute, which asks for production, either use it or lose it, in order to free up lands that are not necessarily being used. Cost estimate for that was about $200,000. Also under that umbrella of leadership and collaboration in the higher priority but longer term implementation, asking for development of a statewide digital geographic information system database that would contain information about estuaries, what's known about the habitat conditions, resource uses, competing uses that may assist in our local governments with land use planning and help them with that decision making at the local level. Cost estimate about $200,000. Also in this category, asking the Oregon Department of Agriculture to work closely with the Oregon Department of State Lands to develop a memorandum of understanding regarding coordination of removal fill permits that relate to commercial mariculture operations. No cost on that. Another category here, important category then, in terms of enhancing commercial shellfish mariculture, and these are high priority, immediate implementation, asking the Department of Agriculture to transfer some of their existing carryover funds from the Tillamook Bay water quality monitoring work that they're doing now, that I think, Sven, you will talk about in a bit, to expand the monitoring work in other bays and estuaries, in particular down on the south coast in Coos Bay. And I think there's about $50,000 there. Another very important one, to provide financial support for continuation of the Oregon State University Molluscan Broodstock Program. Dr. Chris Langdon here runs that program, and he'll provide information about the content of that program. But that's very important in terms of developing long-term lineages that have high economic value, high biological characteristics in terms of growth, meat output, high quality, very important program with a cost of about $570,000. Also in this category of enhancing commercial shellfish mariculture production, a high priority but longer term implementation, is to continue the effective management of aquatic invasive species in our bays and estuaries, and yet at the same time explore some actions that may allow for the transport of non-native species that are important to mariculture, in particular to look at the issue over Manila little neck clams. Okay. Under the big umbrella of gaining a better understanding of the impacts of our changing ocean conditions, and a high priority immediate implementation is to monitor ocean acidification and identify potential impacts of ocean acidification on both the cultivated molluscan shellfish, but also on our native wild stocks. What are the impacts of ocean acidification on our bay clams and on our razor clams, in addition to continuing that very important work in our shellfish hatcheries? Cost estimate there, about $280,000. And another very important element here, to develop a harmful algal bloom monitoring program for the state of Oregon, which is folks are out gathering water samples and looking through microscopes, identifying those diatoms and dinoflagellates. These are microscopic algae that produce the biotoxins that get into our shellfish, cause closures, ultimately then can also get into crabs. As you know, we've had some major delays in the commercial crab seasons. Razor clamming is closed along the whole Oregon coast now due to domoic acid. Oregon is the only state along the west coast that does not have a harmful algal bloom monitoring program. This is important to provide an early warning to supplement the good work that is undertaken right now by the Department of Agriculture Food Safety Program to actually measure those biotoxins in tissues. Under the big umbrella of evaluating the socioeconomic costs and benefits associated with shellfish mariculture or shellfish fisheries, high priority immediate to conduct a baseline socioeconomic study of the commercial molluscan shellfish industry and also to conduct a marketing and sales study for commercial Alaskan shellfish to identify and improve economic opportunities, cost estimates there. And also under this umbrella, to document the economic effects of ocean acidification on commercial cultivation of oysters and to assist the commercial industry to help identify benefits from research and outreach, an estimated cost of about $30,000 there. Under the large umbrella, to increase public education, outreach, and to enhance recreational opportunities, high priority immediate, to conduct public education and outreach activities related to recreational shellfish harvesting, and also to enhance enforcement activities regarding shellfish and to collaborate with coastal Indian tribes. Enforcement activities are undertaken by the Oregon State Police, not by Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Also within this umbrella of increasing public education and outreach, to make the important infrastructure improvements needed to enhance public access and to increase recreational opportunities by providing parking areas, regulation signs, access trails, stairs, and walkways. We do have locations where people are gaining access to recreational tide flats to go harvest bay clams, and they have to trespass, or they have to park on the sides of roads and put themselves at risk as they get in and out of the cars and put their boots on, asking for about $120,000 to make those infrastructure improvements. And then also to broaden the allowable use of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Restoration and Enhancement Fund to allow shellfish projects under that that program that were designed to improve access to recreational shellfish. And then finally here in this category, to develop and install shellfish education and outreach signs in cooperation with our public schools and the port districts, an estimated cost of about $50,000 or so to do that. In the broad category, to assess our populations of wild shellfish stocks in the high priority immediate implementation group, to conduct more frequent shellfish stock assessment surveys in the intertidal area, and also to conduct these surveys in the subtidal area of our bays and estuaries. Cost estimate in the bill, in House Bill 3234, was identified at about $180,000. That would be sufficient to do the scuba work and to add one more FTE to the team. But our recommendation in the task force report was to add three FTE at a higher cost, about $420,000. Also in this category, recommending to initiate a citizen science participation program that would engage the public in our shellfish monitor activities and also in our field surveys for stock assessments. Also in this category of assessing wild shellfish stocks, high priority but longer term, to monitor and analyze the recreational and commercial shelf or clam fisheries to help make more timely adjustments to our harvest regulations. Right now we do that on about a 4 or 5 year basis when our stock assessment team has a chance to reassess the biomass of stocks. That's when we set our quotas and such. This would allow us to have a dedicated scientist on board, fisheries analyst to work with those numbers. And then here as well, to review and analyze state and local permits that affect shellfish habitats in the intertidal and subtidal areas and incorporate that information into resource decision making. And then finally, in the broad category, to restore and enhance our native shellfish as a high priority immediate implementation, to take steps to conserve and protect our populations of wild native Olympia oysters in collaboration with the Oregon coastal tribes and nonprofit groups, other stakeholders. And this is that shellfish that Representative McEwen is wearing on her lapel. So to summarize these, our priority recommendations for 2017 in that high priority immediate implementation, the total cost estimate there was about $2.5 million, distributed $780,000 in House Bill 2784 and about $1.7 million in House Bill 3234. And the high priority longer term implementation, total cost was about $500,000 distributed amongst the two bills. I also need to point out that we also made 13 additional recommendations to be addressed by the initiative over a longer time frame, and those fell into the category of moderate or lower priorities, midterm and longer term implementation. And those additional recommendations are included in both bills. So I want to come back to this important point as well. We were also asking that to give life to this initiative, that we formalize and really designate an Oregon Shellfish Initiative for the state of Oregon, and we organize that really as a multi-year collaborative public-private partnership. That we take steps to designate those representatives, to formulate an oversight committee staffed up and headed by the Oregon Department of Agriculture jointly with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and to provide appropriations for us to get started down the pathway on this job. Okay? Pass this over to Svein.
I can press for you.
Svein West Hansen. I'm a oyster farmer in Tillamook. I work for Pacific Seafood out of Clackamas. I'm also a vice president of the Pacific Coast Shellfish Growers Association. Kind of a couple different hats here today. I was part of California and Washington's process of going through this, and I just want to say that what we came up with in the short amount of time and what's in it, I feel like we did a much better job and actually have something that's going to help move forward. Just the pre-permitting part that we talked about in Washington, there is a 2-page flow chart to get permitted to farm shellfish. It's a 2 to 3 year process. It can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. I think what we have here is going to prevent that from happening in Oregon and actually allow smaller individuals to get into the industry, which is especially important the way we're platted in Oregon. Neatheart Bay, for example, very small, 5-acre parcels, 2-acre parcels, that they're mom and pop operations and they can't afford that long, tedious process. One of the examples of what came out of this is with ODA, there's sanitary rules based on rain and river heights and all that on when we can commercially harvest. So this is Tillamook Bay. North will be to your right. Inside of the yellow lines is one growing area, and everything north of that would be one. What we did through the Shellfish Initiative is we created the blue and the red line where we added samples. That allowed us to take some samples and see if we can expand the open times. Tillamook averaged around 120 days of closures every year to where we are not able to harvest. What this has shown us is there's opportunity to spread that out a little bit and reduce those closures. Believe there's some leftover money in that program. I was talking to Lauren there, and we hope that could get rolled over into the next biennium, if possible, to continue this program and also move towards the Coos Bay items that we've talked about. I say overall, I think it's a very robust bill, both for recreational, commercial, and it creates a way for industry and agencies to actually communicate. Just the process of going through this, we saw that, and that's something I don't see in the other states. Unfortunately, there's a lot of roadblocks. There's a lot of interagency arguing, and I feel like creating the group and the tail end, like you just finished talking about, will prevent that and actually have some open lines of communication to where we can get it all out, hammered out, and keep moving forward.
Great. Welcome.
Good morning. thank you very much for the invitation to come and talk to you this morning. My name is Chris Langdon. I'm a professor at Oregon State University, the Coastal Oregon Marine Experiment Station at the Hatfield Marine Science Center in Newport. And I'm standing in for Gil Sylvia, who was on the task force. I have prepared some written testimony that has been submitted for the record, and Gil has read this and approved it, so sound ground here. I won't reiterate a lot of what I've put in this testimony because much of it has already been very nicely described by Steve Rumble and Sven here. So what I'd like to do is just focus on the area that I feel I'm most expert in, and why this is important for this bill, which is described as part of the bill 3234. And this is work that we've been doing with Oregon State University and the Whiskey Creek Hatchery in Neatarts Bay. So you might have heard through this that we are actually in the eye of the storm here in Oregon in terms of battling with the effects of ocean acidification. In fact, the work that we did in 2007-2006 was the instigator, if you like, of the shellfish initiatives in California and Washington. So this realization that ocean acidification is a real problem originated here and was first really noticed at the Whiskey Creek Hatchery. Now, this hatchery is really important. It's the only independent hatchery on the West Coast that produces seed for many small farmers. And these for small farmers are the type of farmers you see here in Oregon. And the overall, the oyster industry on the West Coast is about worth about $70 million in terms of just dockside value of product. And when this ocean acidification issue occurred in 2007-2006, all of a sudden there was a seed crisis because Whiskey Creek Hatchery could not produce seed for all of these small farmers. And many of them were facing bankruptcy. Well, luckily, at Oregon State University, we have one of the most world-renowned scientists in looking at ocean acidification. He stepped in and realized that this was likely a problem and worked in conjunction with Alan Barton, who is the manager at the Whiskey Creek Hatchery. And they realized that every time there was upwelling period in the summer, there was a problem rearing larvae. So they put in a monitoring system that monitored water quality and alerted the hatchery to the occurrence of these ocean acidification events. And then a little later on, they put in a system where they were able to correct the acidified water biting buffers. So this system is pretty sophisticated, but it's now adopted by most of the hatcheries here on the West Coast and many hatcheries in this country on the East Coast as well as globally. So Burke Hales and George Orbus and my colleagues in the College of Oceanography and Earth Science, Atmospheric Science, have been to New Zealand and France and other countries. So we're asking for funding to continue that program, working in collaboration with Whiskey Creek Hatchery to perfect the system and to carry out some more additional research to try and improve the system. The hatchery is about 70% of its production before this ocean acidification started to become a problem, so there's still some issues that need to be addressed. And the other area that I am working on is developing a breeding program for Pacific oysters. And we've been working on this breeding program since about 1996. It was actually instigated with the help of Senator Hatfield when he was in Congress. And we are basically, as Steve mentioned, we're developing oysters that have high yields on farms. We've improved yields by about 19% since its initiation. And recently we found that the performance of the larvae in hatcheries, such as Whiskey Creek Hatchery, has also improved. As we face these increasingly problematic environmental issues in the future, it's really essential to have some kind of breeding program in place that has very practical application for industry, works very closely with industry. To get funding from federal agencies like NOAA, USDA for this kind of very practical long-term program is really hard. So the support from the state and from that has been proposed in this bill 3234 would be very helpful in continuing this program so that we can develop strains that are going to be more resistant to ocean acidification both on the farms and in the hatcheries. So, in conclusion, this close collaboration with Oregon State University and the industry, I think, has led to some really important breakthroughs, not only for Oregon's oyster farmers, but also nationally and internationally. And the work I think we're doing is really pivotal and critical in addressing some of these long-term challenges that we're going to face as we move into this century. So, thank you very much for your attention.
Great. Questions, please, gentlemen?
I just want
Vice Chair McLean.
I just heard a program on on, I mean, it was probably OPA or Oregon Public Broadcasting, but it was on the acidification. And, you know, are you folks working, and would this group be able to work with folks in both California and in Washington? Have there been some ways to set up how that group could interface, not just the agency, but maybe the group as well?
Yeah.
Because it sounded like there were some interest areas that would concern all three states and would be important for all of us, again, not to reinvent the wheel.
If I can address that in a little bit and then pass it back to Chris, but the three states certainly are working. Washington took off on this and created the Blue Ribbon Panel on Ocean Acidification, and then that spread to California and Oregon as well. So it's grown into the three-state West Coast Science Panel. They've coupled up another ocean condition called hypoxia, which is low dissolved oxygen, which exacerbates the ocean acidification problem. And now the alliance has grown into an international alliance,
okay,
also including our colleagues concerned about this in British Columbia as well.
And the governor's offices in all three states are interwoven into this fight. And then, of course, you know, we work very closely with colleagues, scientists in Washington and California, as well as with the industry. So the industry is important in all of these three states.
Sounds great.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to, that's the end of our little panel. I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 2784. And House Bill 3234, reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3158. Ask Al Elkins and Shannon Hearn to join us. Colleagues, this was Rep. McLean's presentation about the tags or some other kind of incentives in lieu of cash on poaching. Al, I've got you first, but it's your preference. You're friendly. Who wants to go first?
Watch your hand.
Chair Klein, members of the committee, for the record, Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director, Department of Fish and Wildlife. Good morning. Thank you for having this conversation, as well as thank you to Representative McLean for bringing this forward. As you heard, the statistics are astounding when you see the amount of poaching that is going on in Oregon that we think is happening out there. So on the TIP program, there were some questions there. Al can correct me if I'm wrong. It does start out at a 500 base, and it's a partnership between Oregon Hunters Association and OSP that we feed into as well. And then it does go up incrementally. They start adding money, trying to incentivize basically that way of more people knowing that someone out there has information and they might come forward if the price tag goes up. We did look at how many violations went through the tip line that did result in convictions in 2015, I think I have. And that was a total of 62. So not an astounding number, but there isn't a central database at this time to track how many we do get in and what that volume really is out there. I know the Department of Fish and Wildlife receives hundreds of tips of people calling in, suspecting that they're seeing something fishy essentially going on out in the woods and they would like OSP or us to investigate. I will tell you one more thing, and then I'll turn it over to Al. When we look at this language, we have the term wildlife in there again. So it covers all wildlife, so shellfish and fish and anything else. And if you look at the conviction of an unlawful take of wildlife, that covers even reporting inappropriate pesticide use that resulted in killing of red band on the stream and an unlawful take that way. So we would have to go through pretty intensive rulemaking to really set expectations and show what violation convictions would result in this opportunity and what that opportunity is. The other example I wanted to provide was the recent Bighorn Sheep case on I-84. There were actually three individuals who called in that were driving I-84 to report that something was going on, that they could tell a Bighorn Sheep had been potentially killed and that there were individuals there. So that's another effort we'll have to undertake. Do all three then receive the opportunity because they did make the call to clarify? And then, sorry, one more. Once again, we have controlled hunts where we have very few tags, which has already been brought up. And we actually at times have to close areas. The Owyhee unit right now is closed for bighorn sheep. If you have a marijuana grow in there, it gets reported, it goes in, and they did unlawful take a bighorn sheep. That individual would not have that opportunity for that tag because we don't have a season there. And I can tell you that individual would be very disappointed to find out if we weren't very clear that we have the flexibility to not allow that if they expected it. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. First of all, I just can't thank you enough for bringing this topic forward. Sponsors of the bill, Chair for having the hearing. This is a huge, huge issue that we have been working on the last 2 to 3 years with Representative Witt and others to try to get a handle on the situation and come up with a solution. I am currently working with Representative Witt's office on a budget note to put in the budget, ODFW budget, that would actually ask for a campaign, awareness campaign to be developed on poaching and to get the public involved. We are really concerned that awareness is the key to help and to help our partners, the game enforcement officers, tackle this problem. I have spent the last, since the bill was published, I have spent that time to today talking to a number of folks on solutions and where we are in relation to the ideas of how to tackle this problem. Many have come forward with some great ideas. One of them is to raise the restitution from poachers, the actual poachers, the money that goes from the courts to the TIP program, so we could develop more awareness through that program that it exists and how people can access it. As I recall in the bill, there is no, there's nothing in relation to preference points. And whenever we get into discussions about tag giveaway and preference points, we have, instead of 2 or 3 people at our board meetings, we have 200 or 300 people at our board meetings. So it's a topic that we would need as an association to discuss further with the representatives who sponsored this bill. This is an incredible opportunity for us, and we don't want to let it pass us by. We will do anything to help develop an awareness program. I have been told in public meetings as well as private meetings that most likely the take of wildlife is higher illegally than it is legally. I have no statistics to give you, to present to you on that, but I have been told that by a number of people who know what they're talking about in relation to wildlife violations. So this is a huge problem. In closing, I just like to thank you again for bringing this issue forward, and we'll help any way we can, and please help us get a handle on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. Questions? Lots of them. Okay, so let's start with Vice Chair Springer and start moving around.
Thank you, and I appreciate, and I hear the comments that both of you are making. And one of the biggest mistakes I've ever made was in 2011, when I was first assigned to this committee. Somebody came to me and said, "Let's talk about preference points so some of our older hunters can have a better shot."
Mm-hmm.
I will never have that conversation again. You don't talk preference points to hunters,
mm-hmm.
but I have started saying to hunters, because of the issues with younger hunters, mentor programs, and stuff like that, I get preference points. Okay, preference points are a discussion in my house. The reality is, I do believe we probably have more game taken illegally than legally. We're going to have to get over it to figure out a way to address poaching. And I really think when we're talking about hunters, they care more about the tags than they care about the money. They really, really do. And I know that we could have some units that are closed or hit quotas or whatever. I think we just need to figure out a way to work around that. We got to figure out a way. And if you offered a cow tag or something to a hunter to replace an illegal take, I bet they'd switch units and say, can't there, you get another unit. But I think we need to figure out a way to address this, and frankly, I think we're going to have to talk about some of the things as hunters we don't like to talk about, which is our preference points and those kinds of things, because we're going to end up not having hunting if we don't address this. We got cougars taking, on average, each cougar takes one big game animal a week, and if we have an estimated population of over 6,000, that's a lot. So I think these are issues that we're going to have to figure out how to get over and solve, and maybe compromise some of those things that are sacred, like preference points. That was not a question, obviously.
Rep. Escobar.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that you're probably pretty accurate on the more taken illegally than legally. The reason I say that, each poacher you run into, they haven't done it just once. Mm-hmm. In fact, they busted a family down in Eagle Point area. I believe they had 40-some heads just this year or last year when they got busted. So you figure 20-some per hunter. And, of course, they prosecuted them. But we should be able to figure out a good way in order to combat this and where people can get involved. It's not going to get any better until people get involved in it. So we need to find some kind of initiative, and if it's preference points, fine. If it's a tag, I kind of like the preference points part of it, because, and by the way, Representative Springer, if I could get a antelope tag and 5 preference points, I'd just be tickled plumb to death. Last time it took me 16, so, but anyway.
Reparato.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Shannon, I can't remember the numbers you gave, but I think you said 62 or something like that. Was that convictions, or was that just that was convictions?
Chair, so, Representative Barreto, that's convictions for that year. That
and then a follow-up. When this program was implemented down in Utah that Sean Jones was talking about, do we know what the numbers increased in convictions after that?
Chair Clem, Representative Barreto, I do not, and I'd be interested in finding that out for the department, and I can pass it along to you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much. Let me close the public hearing on, Shannon, do you want to stay? Actually, let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3158, open the public hearing on House Bill 2497. And this is... Is Rep. Brocksmith? Yes. There you are. Yes, tell us about this bill.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, Representative David Brocksmith, House District 1. This bill is, as you can see, makes very few changes. It will prescribe a fee for multi-year hunting license and establishes it at $5. Page 3 of the bill removes may and adds shall. So the Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission can already do this. This is just making sure that they do it. So,
okay, let's hear. What do you think about that? Pretty straightforward concept, but
yeah. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, again, Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director of Department of Fish and Wildlife. Here's where we're at with our point-of-sale system. And, you know, we've had it for decades. It's pretty inflexible at this point. We are starting a process basically to go out and talk to our folks that sell licenses, our business needs, our constituents, and see how we can better serve them and what that system needs to look like. So fairly quickly, we'll have an RFP out with a system that is more flexible and programmable. And we want to have it in place by December of 2018. Until we have that in place, we cannot provide multi-year licenses. So when I first analyzed this, we were talking about, you know, a 5-year, 10-year lifetime license like other states are doing, and we're very interested in having that conversation. In fact, a couple legislations ago, we actually did move so that
the commission can approve that. And when we have a program that allows us to do that, we'll get going on it. Through conversations about this bill with the proponents, however, what I've learned is it's actually folks that want it to span 365 days as opposed to a calendar year, which it is currently. Again, our system does not allow us to do that without a significant investment in programming. And here very quickly, we will have the ability to do that. And therefore, the conversation could actually get us there without a significant cost. I do understand in this situation, the individual's issue is he had to purchase a non-resident hunting license to put in for the controlled hunt, because you're required to have a valid license to do that. And then his hunt did not start until after the calendar year, so then he had to buy a second license. So I did look into how often that occurs and why we as the department haven't been hearing it regularly. We have less than 4% of our elk hunts and less than 2% of our deer hunts span a year. So very few out of hundreds of hunts that do this. Most folks do buy licenses both years because they either hunt for other things or they want to put in the controlled hunt twice. So that's why we haven't made this huge investment for this few folks that do have this issue. And that's the best at this point that I can tell you about our ability to actually put this in place if this law passes.
Okay. Questions? Okay. I think, Shannon, you're okay. Roger, can you join us? You can be excused. I'm also going to, well, we'll just wait a moment. We don't want to just stay there for this next one. So, Roger, tell us about this one, then we're going to switch to another bill, then we're going to do our work sessions, then we're going to adjourn early.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer, and I'm here representing the NRA. And this bill was actually drafted and introduced at our request by former Representative Krieger. And as you just heard, I think what we found out after the bill was drafted and discussion with the department, they have the ability now with the word may. They just never done it. But what brought it forward was what you just heard about, is we had some members, both in-state and out-of-state, who were casual hunters. And I define casual hunters are people who don't necessarily hunt every year, but they want to hunt occasionally. And at least one of our members that brought this to our attention had applied for a tag, drew the tag, but it was a cow hunt for elk, and it didn't start until January of the next year. So they were required to buy two hunting licenses in order to hunt for a single tag, single species. So we determined that this does happen, and it probably is an impediment to casual hunting for people who don't want to necessarily hunt every year but would like to occasionally hunt. And I know that the state is trying to do everything they can in order to increase hunter participation, and I think this is a barrier to entry for some hunters. So we've heard now, we've talked to the department, we've heard about the barriers they have with the current system. We're going to be happy to work with them after they get a system online that allows it to be done without spending a whole bunch of extra money. So we anticipate that will happen at some point in time in the future, with or without this bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. We're going to move on. So thank you, Rep. Brock Smith. You want to stay right there? Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2497. Open public hearing on House Bill 2499. Tell us about this bill.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, this bill has to do with vessel permits, and I believe Shannon's going to come up with this one as well. So what happens sometimes is when you have, of course, we're all familiar with the vessel permits whenever we're selling. The permits are sellable.
We might not have to. I think you need to say your name again.
I'm sorry. So. Representative David Brock Smith, House District 1. When you sell a boat, normally you have a fishing permit that goes with it. A lot of folks don't have the resources to go out and spend the hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy both. And so a lot of our fishermen go ahead and do a sale, by owner and carry the note. One of the problems that arises for some of our fishermen is there's a default by the buyer, and that causes issues with regards to the folks being able, or the seller, to be able to go to court and stop the buyer from being able to utilize the permit and go out and fish. This just basically establishes a framework for which an injunction can occur, so that that seller, who is or could have or does, you know, bank on those payments as, you know, his income, his or her income, can then get the permit back so that they can go out and use it to generate revenue to support their families. It's that simple.
Did you want to say something?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director, Department of Fish and Wildlife. It's not super complex, but just to be clear, so each of these vessel permits have a value associated with it because they're limited entry permits. We do not mandate what the sell of it is, but we do process the transfers. And there's criteria that these folks have to meet in order for the buyer to sell it to give it to the seller. So what is happening here is there's an agreement made, there's a purchase price. Sometimes the seller will start fishing on that permit, and that's all because we've gone through the transfer process, and then they default on the payments back to the buyer. And so it gets in the court system, and meanwhile the seller can't fish on that permit and isn't receiving any funds from it. So rather than remove the transfer process that's already been occurring, what they would like is us to develop rules that basically says once there's a preliminary injunction and it's out there, no one can fish on it for it. Develop rules so basically it can go back to the seller can fish on it.
Right.
Mm. Pretty simple, but I made it much harder.
Okay. Any questions for these two? Great. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2497. Let me open the work session on House Bill 2576. We've got some dash ones. Colleagues, you may remember this was a discussion about academic research and the ballot measure that passed and an exemption to make clear academic research is not running afoul of the ballot measure. The two sides have met. They're both out there. You both like these dash ones? That's a thumbs up. Like the dash ones? That's a thumbs up. Let's get a motion on the dash ones.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated 3/9/17.
Vice Chair Springer moves the dash one amendments dated 3/9/17. Misty, these dash ones are creating an academic exemption for educational institutions?
Yes, Chair Clem, members of the committee, they clarify the terms of the exemption for scientific or educational institutions, and it removes the reference to the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species in the definition of covered animal species.
Any discussion on these amendments?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative West.
Thank you. Is there any known opposition to the amendments as presented at this point?
No. You've got the petitioners out there.
Group hugs are wonderful.
Yeah, group hugs are. Okay. Any further discussion on the amendments? Any objections? So adopted. And then the bill.
Oh. Okay. Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2576 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Springer moves House Bill 2576.
Mr. Chair.
Rep. Escobar, I'm sorry.
Yes, I would like to have Mr. Beckstead come up. I have a couple of questions, which I think he's seen beforehand. We'd just like to get it on the record.
As do I.
Okay. And
I need to go.
Where were you? You were in the middle of saying your motion? Which is fine.
Yeah,
we can do that, but we'll do it, we'll do it again
in
a minute. Okay, what's the question?
Fantastic. Thank you.
What's the question again?
No, I just asked him how he was doing.
Oh. Yeah, but you wanted him up here for something other
right.
than that.
I think he's maybe referring to the fact that I'm on day three of battling a particularly feisty little bug.
Oh, I gotcha.
So,
okay, yeah. For the record, you are?
Sorry. Yeah. For the record, Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States.
And I have four questions that have been written out. Mr. Beckstead has received those. They're real fast. Mr. Beckstead, according to ODF&W, Oregon commercial fishers catch and process approximately 2 million pounds of skate per year. These fish are harvested in a sustainable, federally managed fishery. These fish are processed and sold throughout the world. Will federal managed fisheries, such as the commercial skate fishery, be prohibited by House Bill 2576 with the -1 amendment or ballot measure 100?
Sorry.
Chair, can I respond?
Yeah, absolutely, please.
I'm asking you
We're going to start losing members here in a second, and we'll lose quorum.
Representative Esquivel, thank you for the question. Yes, a couple of points under that question. First, skates are not one of the prohibited species under Measure 11. Skates are not the same species as ray. They're in the same order as sharks, rays, and guitar fish, but they're a completely different animal. So that's the first response. The second response is that under Section 2, Sub B, the prohibitions do not apply when the activity is expressly authorized by federal law and when the activity involves a species that is subject to a federal management plan, which skates are. So,
next question.
Chair? Next question. Yep.
Is Native North American artwork constructed of walrus ivory included in the prohibitions contained in House Bill 2576 with the -1 amendment or ballot measure 100?
Chair Clem, Representative Esquivel, no. Walruses are not included in the prohibitions.
Next question.
Yes. Is Native American artwork containing small amounts of walrus ivory included in the prohibition of 2576 and the -1 amendments or the ballot measure 100? Small amounts.
Thank you, Chair Clem, Representative Esquivel. Possession by enrolled members of federally recognized tribes is expressly allowed under Measure 100. However, for everyone, the sale and purchase of those items, should they contain any prohibited part or product, and what we would probably be talking about here with respect to Native tribes would be whalebone, because that's a product that I think is used by some tribes. So there would continue to be, under Measure 100, a prohibition on the sale or purchase, but not on the mere possession.
Thank you. Last question. Are Oregon's mountain lions included in the prohibitions contained in House Bill 2576 and the -1 amendment or ballot measure 100?
Chair Clem, Representative Esquivel, the answer is no. Cougars are a separate species from the lions that are listed under measure 100.
Thank you, sir.
You bet.
Did someone else have some more you need to do?
Thank you.
Oh, that answered. Okay. Any further questions? Okay. Could you make your motion again?
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2576 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Springer moves House Bill 2576 as amended to the floor. As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Okay. Seeing none, pass. We'll, I think it's Rep. Rayfield's bill, and so I'll ask him if he wants to carry it. And with that, anything else for the good of the order? All right. Thank you. Committee's adjourned.
Okay, I have to go. Good job, Mr. Chair. 15 minutes early.
Stuff later.
He has to go. That's why.